Earlier this week, From the Vault producer Christopher Sprinkle spoke with Professor Robert Cohen, the co-editor of the 2002 book, The Free Speech Movement, Reflections on Berkeley in the 1960s, to contextualize the events of the late 1964 and explain their lasting effects, if any.
At the end of the documentary, it was said that then, in 1965, was still too early to tell if the Senate's actions and the compromise would succeed. I'm joined by a man who, more than most, can probably answer that question. On the phone in New York is Robert Cohen, who's professor and chair of the Department of Teaching and Learning at NYU, and he's also the co-editor of the 2002 book, The Free Speech Movement, Reflections on Berkeley in the 1960s, and he's the author of a book he's presently working on concerning the political life of Mario Savio. Thank you for joining us, Professor Cohen.
Oh, you're welcome.
What do you think? Did the Senate's actions actually succeed?
Yeah, the reason why there was uncertainty about the December 8th resolution, it was a question about really who does govern the university. You know, the Academic Senate is representative of the faculty, and the question, one question with the university that the Free Speech Movement was always very interested in and took a strong position was that who governs the university? The Free Speech Movement thought the university should be governed by the students and the faculty, but then what's really happened in the course of the 20th century is you've got a professional administration that runs universities, the university bureaucracy, and at the top of it is the Board of Regents. So what was uncertain was would the regents accept the Berkeley Academic Senate's December 8th resolution, which essentially endorsed the free speech position of the free speech movement, which said that the content of political advocacy should not be regulated by the university, which is a very strong free speech position. Essentially, the regents did not endorse it per se. Instead, they said that they would not violate the First and 14th Amendments, which sort of de facto. In other words, they couldn't graciously say that the faculty and the free speech had been right, because in a sense, the movement had defeated their representative, which was President Kerr. So instead, they kind of grudgingly went along. They did try. There were also attempts over the course of 1965 to put other restrictions in place. There was a bunch of different attempts to further. To see if they couldn't clamp down again and restrict speech in certain ways. There was, I guess I would say, a sort of low-level harassment, but they couldn't really undo what the Berkeley Academic Senate had done because of the free speech movement, which was to say that the content of political political speech ought not be regulated by the university.
Can you do one thing? Like, you actually received your doctorate in history from UC Berkeley. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Can you, for people who aren't familiar with Berkeley, I've actually lived up there for a period of time myself, mm-hmm. So I know Sproul Hall and also kind of the layout of the campus. Can you describe a little bit when you were talking about the differences? They were trying to move them from upper Sproul to lower, and kind of what that meant and the terms of how popular those areas are and how much walk-by traffic you get?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, the ruling really has to do with the main South Campus entrance to the University of California, which is right as you come off of Bancroft and Telegraph Avenue. You come into this main plaza outside the administration building that runs on the other side is the Student Union building. It's a big plaza where just during lunchtime there are just hundreds or thousands of people walking through there. It's a very busy corridor. And so, and by the way, that's one of the reasons why the university administration wanted to clamp down on free speech to begin with, because they saw all these scruffy-looking dissidents doing political advocacy at the entrance to the campus. And for conservatives like Alex Sheriffs, who later on ended up being an education advisor to Ronald Reagan, who was the vice chancellor, this was something that, just didn't look proper for a university campus. And so he wanted to clamp down on it. It's a very important access point for the campus. And people who were sort of hostile to dissident politics saw it was like almost a captive audience. You came onto this campus and you're immediately assaulted, and this is how they put it, by this by dissident and radical politics, But that was a kind of intolerant way of putting it. But on the other hand, there's a certain rightness to what they were saying in this respect, that it was a very rare situation where people who are dissidents, who are on the left, who have different types of politics, get access to a free forum in which a lot of the university community passes through. If you think about that today, it's sort of like how many revolutionaries or radicals do you see on TV? You know, they don't have access to this free forum. They have free speech, right? But they can't get on TV. They can't get into a public forum in the way that somebody who has, you know, is backed by commercial TV can. Similarly, what if you think about that in the campus context, what this meant was that if you have this free speech area, especially with a microphone, it means that people who would have dissident politics, who might have views that aren't being expressed on in this classroom, are able to have access to students and faculty administration as they walk onto campus. And what students felt about that was it was a really incredible political education, a way to just enhance your education in ways that were very powerful that lots of students really appreciated, not just radical students, but all kinds of students were encountering civil rights ideas, civil rights movement, all kinds of dissident ideas were they were coming into contact through this forum. It was just an amazing place for the free exchange of ideas. But actually, let me back up for a second and just explain that the plaza itself, which is now a big free speech area, was not the free speech area prior to the free speech movement. At the time of the free speech movement, what happened was they had a sidewalk area that was on the fringes of the campus, on Bancroft and Telegraph. It was a little part of a little sidewalk area where these political tables could be set up. The university, and this is something that most people don't understand, the university actually restricted political advocacy on campus traditionally and allowed those tables to be going on that sidewalk because they thought that sidewalk was on public property. And you think about that, it's kind of interesting that they would allow more free speech off campus than on campus. If you think about that, that's kind of a strange concept because we think about academic freedom and freedom of speech should be especially powerfully protected on the campus. But prior to the free speech movement, it was just this little, almost like a safety valve that was right off the campus where there was the free speech area. And in 64, they tried to close that free speech area down for reasons we can talk about.
I'm speaking with Professor Robert Cohen, who's working on a book right now concerning the political life of Mario Savio. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Mario and what happened to him after the protests and what he ended up doing with his political life?
Well, do you want me to, can I start first with talking about his beginnings of his work on the free speech movement?
Yes, please, please.
Okay. Well, Mario had been involved, he became politically active at Berkeley by becoming involved in the Bay Area civil rights movement. There was a big coalition of Berkeley students, and, you know, which at that time was a predominantly white student body, and the local African-American community. They were trying to eliminate job discrimination in local employers. And Mario was, his first arrest came during the sit-in at the Sheraton Palace Hotel in the spring of 64, where they were trying to stop job discrimination against African Americans in that hotel. So, and when he was in jail for his role in that sit-in, he encountered a person who asked him if he was going to Mississippi in the summer, and he didn't know what he was talking about, and it turned out that he was talking about Mississippi Freedom Summer. So Mario actually did sign up and ended up going down to Mississippi in the summer of 1964 to work in doing voter registration work and teaching in freedom schools in Mississippi. That was the summer when Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman were killed. It was a very dangerous time down there. And he came back really planning to continue his civil rights work. He wasn't really planning to launch a free speech movement. But the reason why the free speech movement meant so much to him was when they would try to close down that free speech area, that was the area in which he'd been recruited to go to that first demonstration in San Francisco that led him to Mississippi and changed his life. And he thought it was outrageous that here was the freest part of the country, and it was being closed down, the part of the country where we could get recruits and money to support the civil rights movement in the South for this historic freedom struggle, being shut off by these administrators. So that's how he got involved in it.
Can you describe the impact of that movement across the country and on other campuses, and as well with Mario Savio?
First of all, it really empowered students. I mean, generally speaking, you know, the administration has all the power on college campuses, and students basically are to obey orders, right? They've got no power. They don't have degrees. They don't make the rules. It's a hierarchy. You know, the university is not a democracy. And what the free speech movement did was to show that students didn't have to be treated as if they had no power or any voice. It gave them a voice, and it did it by taking the by taking the methods of the civil rights movement, that is, civil disobedience. Sit-ins, was the campus sit-in, for example, student strikes, mobilizing students in numbers, students expressing solidarity for one another, and standing together. And that gave them an incredible leverage to challenge administrations all across the country when they did things that students didn't like. So what that meant was, as the Vietnam War expanded, students now had a way of protesting universities' involvement in the defense establishment. They could say, well, we don't want to have military research being done here. We don't want to have a ROTC. We don't want the armed forces on campus. We don't want Dow Chemical coming, you know, when they're trying to recruit people because they make napalm that's used to kill Vietnamese children. This gave the student movement students a voice and leverage to have their voices and concerns matter on campus. And so, in a way, it really was greeted with it really empowered student protesters in an amazing way throughout the 60s. On the other hand, it really scared and upset a lot of the public and a lot of administrators who didn't like this, you know, who were afraid of the disorder of the student movement. And in fact, you know, it's interesting to think about this in retrospect, but the free speech movement, I mean, think about it in terms of its goals, was about, you know, free speech. Who can oppose free speech? You'd think that it'd have majority support from, say, the people of California. And actually, no. The polls had showed quite the opposite, that the public was really opposed to the free speech movement. Why? Not because of the issue of free speech, which they paid no attention to, but because the students were, you know, using these tactics of civil disobedience. Even though it was nonviolent, it was breaking the law and breaking school rules. And so for people off campus who were, you know, afraid of disorder, they saw this as a terrible thing, that students were, you know, breaking the law and flouting authority, and it was like chaos, and this is what Berkeley, and so the phrase among administrators would be, oh, don't do that, we don't want another Berkeley here. You were asking about Mario afterwards, what became of Mario, what was he?
Yeah, because I know that there was a while where he shunned that leadership role and yeah, kind of went into not hiding, but he avoided the press and wasn't really a spokesman. And I know that he ended up many years later actually going back to university and worked in a university. But can you describe kind of those years after for him?
Well, Mario was always ambivalent about being in a position of political leadership. First of all, he never aspired to political leadership. He wasn't interested in power. And that made him, you know, it's very unusual in politics for people to not be interested in power. He was really involved in these protests as a kind of a moral thing. He thought politics should be a branch of ethics, not be about efficiency, and certainly not be about getting himself power. He wasn't interested in that. He didn't want that. Mario was not going to try to capitalize on his prominence as a political leader by going into politics. And in fact, he wasn't really comfortable in the political spotlight. He was really, and this goes back to his experience in the civil rights movement and SNCC. It's Bob Moses in the civil rights movement was pretty similar to this, that what you want to do as an organizer is to empower the community, not to build celebrity. A successful political organizer was about empowering other people, not about promoting himself. And so Mario, you know, would talk about how, you know, if there'd be five speakers, you know, that famous speech he gave on Sproul Plaza on December 2nd, he wasn't the only speaker. There were at least, you know, there were at least three other steering committee members who spoke, yet his words are the ones that got remembered. And this was continually happening, that other people would speak at these rallies and only his would get reported. And he realized, well, you know, it shows that he was doing a good job, but also it made him feel, he felt embarrassed about it. It was as if, you know, he was the free speech movement, and he didn't agree with that.
I'm speaking with Robert Cohen, who is a scholar of American student protest movements and is also working on a book right now concerning the political life of Mario Savio. Robert Cohen is the professor and chair of the Department of Teaching and Learning at NYU University, and he also was a co-editor of a 2002 book called The Free Speech Movement, Reflections on Berkeley in the 1960s. And I want to thank you very much for coming onto the program and kind of relating the events from the 60s that we heard about in the first half hour of the program and kind of contextualizing them and letting us know a little bit of the effects of both the free speech movement and the life of Mario Savio.
Oh, sure. You're welcome.
That was Robert Cohen speaking to From the Vault producer Christopher Sprinkle. And unfortunately, that is all the time we have this week. From the Vault is produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. To purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials used within this week's program, go online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us at the archives 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is presented as part of the Preservation and Access Project, which is funded in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California at Berkeley's Moffitt Library, at the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners. From the Vault's theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening.